This is The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. Real Madrid lift the European Cup for the 14th time then. One shot on target, one goal, one incredible goalkeeper, an ageless, aging midfield. Dani Carvajal with the game of his life. An absolutely extraordinary journey to the final where they were dead and buried three times. And now this, a 1-0 win over Liverpool where maybe they weren't the better team, but it also feels like they thoroughly deserved it. Carlo Ancelotti now the most successful manager in the history of this competition. And what of Liverpool? Was playing in every single game this season, just a little bit too much. Did Trent Alexander-Arnold show us that vulnerability we all think he has, or did they simply come up against the best version of Thibaut Courtois? We will of course talk about what happened to the Liverpool fans before and after the game, with UEFA and the French authorities desperate to blame the bottlenecks and crushes on the supporters while the trouble was happening amid stories of kids getting pepper sprayed. We'll speak to people who were there in what looks like an abject failure in organisation. Also today, delight for Grimsby, Port Vale and Western United. An important musical question for John Bruin, your questions. And that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. Thomas says, Real Madrid play for approximately 8% of the full 90 minutes of a typical Champions League game. When will the panel finally rise to this level of performance? Let's find if they've got 8% within them today. Barry Glendenning, hello.
Hi, Max. How are you doing?
I'm all right. Thank you. John Bruin, hello.
Good morning, Max.
And in Paris, Jonathan Wilson. Good morning.
Morning. How are you doing?
I'm all right. John says, in the last 6 days, I've witnessed defeat at Wembley with Wrexham, lost the Premier League to Man City, watched Wrexham lose 5-4 in the 119th minute of the playoffs today, and Liverpool lose the Champions League tonight. Can anyone beat that? Football is a bastard. And Tom says, by the way, 4 years down the line, I'm still waiting for Modric to get tired. The game itself, where do we start? Should we start with Thibaut Courtois? Michael says, how many of those saves would Barry have made? He was, Barry, sensational yesterday, and two of those saves were world class.
Yeah, he was outstanding, and it was particularly heartwarming to see after the game that he apparently was inspired by not being put on a list of top 10 goalkeepers by some magazine or other, and because some weirdos on Twitter were giving him abuse when he was at Chelsea. So I like that. Spite is a great motivation, and I'm wholeheartedly in favour of it. It was an outstanding performance by him, and I suppose one of those performances where Liverpool will perhaps are entitled to feel slightly aggrieved that he played so well, but he's as much a member of the Real Madrid team as any of the outfield players, and he's part of a defence that kept Liverpool scoreless for, well, then now that's three cup finals in a row, as we've heard, or as we all know, and has been pointed out that they have failed to score. He had Mo Salah beating the ground and howling with frustration, and that's quite a good place to be for a goalkeeper, I suppose.
You were there, Wilson. I don't know if we're in the stadium, he looks bigger than your average goalkeeper. But those moments, it's very hard to see when you're watching it live. You can't see that the fingertips he saves from Mane specifically.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's probably the last of the saves was the one that looked really impressive. When Salah, you know, with two brilliant touches, suddenly was bearing down on goal and he opened up his body. And we've all seen that Salah finish a million times. And you sort of think, oh, they are. Because I'd sort of just gotten to the mindset of, they're never going to equalise here. This is 1-0. And in that moment, you thought, no, this is it, actually. And then suddenly you just sort of see this green arm shooting up and pushing the ball away. And the way that Madrid's defence reacted to that save, there's three of them immediately jumped on him. At the final whistle, Luka Modric ran straight to Courtois. So they were clearly very aware of how exceptional this performance had been. So I think after that save from Salah, you sort of think, there's no way through.
And I presume, John, like all the Real Madrid players, this was like his 10th Champions League title. But actually, it's Courtois' first. And I think he spoke about 2014 as well, when he was playing for Atleti against Real Madrid in the final, letting that goal from Ramos in injury time. And so this is kind of a, you know, he's pretty sure of himself. We know that. He was asked before the game, who are the two most important players? He went, well, me and Karim Benzema. But it's still a great moment for him.
Yeah, absolutely. And this thing about him not getting respect in England, I think when he was at Chelsea, one of the problems he had, of course, that he succeeded Petr Cech, who is probably the greatest of all Chelsea goalkeepers, give or take, Peter Benetti. There were problems at Chelsea, weren't there? He wasn't considered mobile enough in that modern goalkeeping style where you've got to play the ball at your feet, which I don't think he's still the best at. But in a team like Real Madrid, which has... I mean, their defence is almost like and Jonathan will correct me here, I'm sure, but some sort of catenaccio effect on that game, which is they sat back, defend deep. My memory of the game, when I think back in the images of it, you know, Edgar Militao winning everything in the air. Danny Carvajal, as you said in the intro, Max, absolutely killing it. David Alaba is, you know, a very, very good defender. And players sweeping up in front of them and the ball going to Modric and him controlling the ball and buying time and taking the sting out of Liverpool. But you need your goalkeeper to be on form as well if you're going to sit up and soak up pressure. And Courtois came through. He arrived in England with a very big reputation. I don't think he lived up to, but I do think now, after that performance, he could probably consider himself in the top 10 goalkeepers in the world. If you're listening, Thibaut, you just about made it, mate. So don't get too angry about this.
So Wilson, is there a sense that Real Madrid kind of athletied their way to win this game?
No, not really, because I don't think there was the level of aggression or, you know, this wasn't about the dark arts. They just sat deep I have to say, I was slightly surprised when I looked at the stats and saw Liverpool had 24 shots to 4. I mean, I knew Liverpool had more, but that felt... 24-4 felt more than it did in the moment. And Klopp referred to that afterwards. You know, he was sort of saying, well, we only really had three chances where he thought that Liverpool were going to score. So I guess that is a sign of good defending, that you're restricting the opposition to long-range shots chances with a low XG. And I don't know. I mean, I guess it just sort of followed the narrative of everything that had gone before. You just sort of... When you saw that break coming, and I was sat next to Barney, and we were both sort of going, why is Alexander-Arnold not looking over his shoulder? Why is... You must know, Vinicius says, oh, he doesn't know he's there. Oh, no.
Did he actually, on the goal, I mean, I don't know if that decide, that you know, obviously that is the moment that defines this game in a way. But Didier Hamann tweeted, look, if you look at where the ball comes from Valverde and where it goes, even if he knew, he was, you know, he's perfectly in line. So he's basically playing the perfect line, Trent Alexander-Arnold there, that actually defensively sometimes you just can't do anything. Or is that giving him a free pass?
I think the cross from Valverde is pretty much perfect. I just think that the point is, in that whole break, Alexander-Arnold never gets within 3 yards of Vinicius. I don't know if it's, you know, if he could have checked his run slightly just to get in his way. It sort of felt almost like, you know, it was like a moving cone rather than being a defender. I mean, it was right in line, because Barney and I were on the left side of the press box as you looked at the pitch, so it was exactly where the goal happened. And for sort of a good, I mean, it probably wasn't that long, but it felt like about 5 minutes before. It definitely wasn't 5 minutes. For a good sort of 5 seconds before the goal, or maybe half a second, I don't know, but for a period of time, it felt significant before the goal. We were both going, why is it? It's just going to go to Vinicius. He's going to say, oh, that's exactly what's happened. Why are we not stopping that?
How often are you and Barney sitting next to each other, sort of Nostradamus, like Maradona's, that he's going to handball that and then it happens? Is this a sort of very regular occurrence that you sort of predict?
Not these days, because Barney and I very rarely do the same games, because we're, yeah, now that we work for the same paper on a more sort of regular basis. It's never really, it's more Sutherland Waldorf and Nostradamus as well, to be honest.
Well, what's it like sitting beside Barney at a game? Does he bring Haribo? Does he bring interesting chat? Or does he just get exasperated a lot?
He had some kind of plant-based product with salt and pepper. Very nice. He was very kind in sharing them around. It's a very pleasant experience. I can recommend it to anybody. Unless you're asking, what are you writing about so I can write something different? And he seems very reluctant to commit to that at an early stage, shall we say.
Oh, you can't copy his homework. That's what you're just looking. Are you like peering over his shoulder going?
Oh, I'm peering over his shoulder so I don't write the same thing, because he won't tell me what he's writing.
Manuel says, do you think the Vinicius goal was meant to be in the 93rd minute, but due to the delay, it was scored 30 minutes earlier? That's a very good question. And actually, in that build-up to the goal, there was one pass from Modric with his left foot between the lines. And he, John, is... He's just so sensationally good, Modric. And it just seems ridiculous that three are still at the top of football. And I just don't know when do they... I mean, Camavinga's come in a lot in this tournament, right? He's sort of come off the bench for Toni Kroos or whatever. But still, those three are delivering at this elite level when I'm sure all of us have written them off at some point. I've done it a million times.
Yeah, it's for, people have written off Casemiro. I think he's only 30, but he's got through so much running and so much work over the years that you think that he's run himself into the ground. And Kroos, I think he's only 32, but Modric, the master, the best midfielder, I would say, in Europe over the last 10 years. The only one to win a Ballon d'Or, of course. And it's the cliche, isn't it? The best players have the most time on the ball. Well, there isn't anybody that has as much time on the ball as Modric. At any point he receives the ball, or whatever angle he receives it, he makes the time to take the ball, play the pass, and then read the pass two or three ahead so that he can be there to receive the ball back from the third player in the line. He is a sensational player. And I wouldn't say he gets better with age, but in his old age, and he may well play on for longer, who knows, he's still got it. He's maybe he didn't dominate the first half in the way that you'd expect the world's best midfielder to do. But when Real Madrid needed to buy time to soak up pressure, give the ball to Modric, he'll find a way out of the problem. And yeah, a brilliant, brilliant player. And it's been an absolute privilege to watch him over his career. I did see a tweet that we received asking if he regretted leaving Spurs.
Probably as much as Ancelotti regrets leaving Everton, right?
Well, absolutely, look, Barry, yes.
We'll get on to Liverpool's performance, but it is worth considering this Real Madrid run to the final. You know, the teams that they've had to get past and the way they've done it and all these moments, you know, that Courtois save from Grealish with his studs and injury time, like the you know, Rodrigo's two goals, Benzema's sort of ludicrous hat-trick against PSG, etc. It's been... I can't remember a more ridiculous set of games to get to a final.
Yeah, it's been quite a white-knuckle ride for them, and you can't say they don't deserve it, given the teams they've beaten and the manner in which they've beaten them. PSG, Chelsea, Man City, Liverpool. And bear in mind that in the group stages, we were all laughing at them because they got beaten by Sheriff Tiraspol, and everyone thought it was hilarious and indicative of some calamitous demise for Real Madrid. So I don't begrudge them at all. I'm not a fan of Real Madrid as an institution or a club, but I find it hard to begrudge them because they've provided so much astonishing entertainment. You know, last night was only a 1-0, but I loved every minute of the game. It was fantastic. Although it was still only the second best game I saw yesterday. We'll get to that later, I guess. And I love Carlo Ancelotti. I'm old enough to remember him winning the Champions League as a player with AC Milan. And looking at him now, it's hard to believe he was once a magnificent footballer in a brilliant AC Milan side, but he was. Kids, ask your fathers or grandfathers. And it is a fantastic achievement for them. And I don't begrudge them it one bit.
Dani Ceballos said, when I saw all those players, Karim, Carvajal, Modric playing cards just a few hours before the game, I thought, wow, well, there's a calmness. Anyway, I couldn't even sleep the siesta. Are they punching above their weight? This is a ridiculous question to ask about Real Madrid, John. But you know, given the finances that other clubs have, or is that a completely ludicrous question?
Well, it's almost as if they're rather existing on old money a bit, aren't they? Because Karim Benzema was a huge signing back in 2009. Luka Modric was a big signing back in 2011. I think that's about right. The issue that they've got, and it has been the big issue for them before this game, is how do you regenerate Real Madrid beyond this old guard? Obviously, we've had the Mbappe affair. L'affaire Mbappe, you might call it.
You're quite pleased with yourself there, John. It's early on a Sunday morning.
Yeah.
A bit of French, but well done.
No, a bit of franglais, yeah. for le matin. There you go. I think we thought this was the end of the empire when Cristiano Ronaldo left. They clearly thought it was the end of the empire because they've involved themselves in this Super League nonsense and, you know, the joke is, isn't it? Of course, the team that didn't want to be in a competition wins it the next year. They are relying a little bit on old money. But then again, there are young players like Vinicius Jr. coming through. You mentioned Camavinga, you know, who's the most wanted young midfielder. And they will, it seems to me that they'll be picking around the fringes of the star players, but they aren't signing the Haalands and the Mbappes these days. So the team is going to regenerate a little bit. But the idea of Real Madrid, which is something that Florentino Perez in his post-match quotes painted as some sort of battle against the petrodollar, this rebel outsider club, this underdog, you can't really do that because it's Real Madrid, the most haughty institution in all of football, let's face it.
Barry, you said that losing this final would constitute a disappointing season for Liverpool. I mean, do you stand by it? Have they had a poor season?
I think so, yeah. On the face of it, they, you know, less than a week ago, this day a week ago, there was talk of the quadruple. This day a week ago, they looked like they were minutes away from snatching the title, and they didn't win it. That's fair enough. The possible quadruple everyone was talking about, they've won the two most minor trophies and failed in the two mega trophies. Now, if you're a Liverpool fan and you've been following them or going to games, I'm sure it's been a wonderful season and a very entertaining season. They've played every single game they could have played in. But I think the record books will show this season for them was no better than the George Graham Arsenal double cup winning team that, as people have unkindly pointed out, had Steve Morrow in it, even if he was missing for the FA Cup final because Tony Adams dumped him on the ground and broke his collarbone by accident. Look, Liverpool fans will scoff, but I think if I was a Liverpool player, and it's recency bias as well because they've lost the two most recent big trophies available. If I was a Liverpool player waking up this morning, I would be gutted.
Hmm. I mean, there is a question, Wilson, about, you know, at this level, right, these fine margins, right at the top, as Jonathan says, why have supposedly free-scoring Liverpool managed to play three finals this season and not score a single goal? Is over 330 minutes of football bad luck or something else? And also, look, they didn't, in the league, they didn't beat Man City once, Chelsea once, or Tottenham once. So when they come up against the, inverted commas, best teams, okay, it's harder, but they don't have a victory. Man City in the semi-final of the FA Cup, I think, but City played a sort of slightly weakened team.
Yeah, no, I think that's a very good point. I mean, the odd thing about the margins, given how much money Liverpool have, winning the Cups, you know, who did they beat in the FA Cup? Forest and Norwich and Cardiff and Shrewsbury? Was that the run before they played City in the semi?
I couldn't tell you why I'm last week, Wilson. Not again.
they should win those games. So there's a sense in which winning a Cup is winning a Cup. It's a great achievement. But there's a sense that that's less of an achievement than staying within touching distance of City in the league. To be getting over 90 points in a league season is, in historical terms, incredibly difficult. Very, very few teams have done it. And that's a problem, I think, of the financing in modern football, that their greatest achievement is not the stuff they've won and the stuff they've just missed out on. But that, you know, that's slightly side issue to why can they not do it against the very biggest, very best teams. I mean, Klopp's got this issue in finals generally, that six finals between 2013 and 2018, they failed to win. Yeah, the two they have won, they needed penalties. And there, you know, you give Klopp credit because he brought in NeuroElf, that German neurological firm, and that's, I don't know how much difference that makes, but they've scored 18 out of 19 penalties in shootouts this season in finals, which suggests it's going pretty well.
He just needs Neuer Svolf for the actual game, doesn't he? Yeah.
Are those the lads that put that thing on Trent Alexander-Arnold's head in training that make him look like Doc from Back to the Future?
Yeah, absolutely. Unfortunately, they kept it on, so he couldn't turn around to see Vinicius Jr. That was an issue.
Can I just say, actually, in Trent Alexander-Arnold's defence, because I see he's been getting a lot of abuse on Twitter, which is no great surprise, some of it from Liverpool fans, he sent in at least five brilliant crosses last night, and Liverpool should have scored from at least three of them. So yeah, I think he deserves a bit of a break. He was outstanding going forward.
He was, but it's pretty unfortunate he did that interview with Donald McRae in the build-up to the final, for which the headline was, "I can see things that other players can't." Yes, but not the opposing left winger when he's making a pretty basic run.
Yeah, John, do you think Liverpool have tired? I mean, Richard says towards the end of the season, Liverpool have lacked ideas going forward. Had they been found out, would Mane or Salah leaving be that much of a disaster? I thought Firmino, they were more threatening when Firmino came on. I mean, there's an important point that footballers can get tired, however many things you put on their heads and electrodes, because they've had to just be at it every single game for this whole season.
Yeah, I think so. Jonathan is better placed than me, but you know, you have these ideas that you have these teams that play every game in a season, like Leeds United, going back to the late 60s, early 70s, and miss out on trophies. But I think we consider them, you know, 50 years on, a great team. And I think we'll probably consider Liverpool a great team for going so close. But I think that's true. I think they peaked maybe March, April. I think perhaps, I mean, he's been a great signing, but I think Luis Diaz wasn't that convincing. Mane, not that convincing. Salah, certainly not that convincing since he's come back from the Cup of Nations. And I think Liverpool have, in certain games, in big pressure games, I think there is something of a mental block there, or there has appeared to be a mental block there. And I think that also happened in Paris last night. Is tiredness a factor in that? It has to be, doesn't it, after such a long season? But I do think that as brilliant a football as that Liverpool play, they do lack that extra dimension. And, you know, as good as Trent Alexander-Arnold is coming forward as a playmaker from the right wing, it can be a little bit predictable. That's why they signed Thiago, I think, isn't it, to change up the style of play. And it took them very far this season.
But I think on that point, it's significant. Yeah, Thiago in the warm-up clearly wasn't happy.
Yes,
it was obvious to us all. And there was, you know, the players were in two groups. So there's the group that was starting and the group that wasn't starting. And Naby Keita moved from the non-starting to the starting group. And Thiago was training by himself. So I think there was doubt over his fits. And he didn't impose himself at all. But no. I think the fact that Klopp played him from the start when there were such obvious concerns suggests just how much he felt they needed that creativity that he brings and that extra control that he brings.
Well, judging by Keita's shot towards the end of the game.
Oh, God, that was terrible. Wasn't it?
If in doubt.
Yeah.
Ali says, I was watching the UEFA feed and Don Goodman, the co-com, had to step in as lead commentator when the main commentator, Tony Jones, lost his voice at halftime and did a wonderful job. Which one of the pod members had ever had to step in for a job they weren't qualified for to that scale? That was the commentary team that we had. And it's always quite fun when I get the script, you know, the day before we're doing the Europe, the whichever Champions League game, it says commentators, Andy Hinchcliffe and Peter Drury. I go, oh, it's them, you know. And it was like Tony Jones and Don Goodman. I was like, oh, that's interesting. We had Peter Drury for the Conference League. But anyway, so we do all our build-up and then we go, and then, you know, you always have to do it in the same way. Let's get the first half. Your commentary team is Don Goodman and Tony Jones. And then it just cut to this man going, hello, it's the Champions League final. His voice had absolutely gone. It was totally gone. Poor bloke had laryngitis. I mean, presumably he noticed before, unless it was like, you know, when Alan Brazil goes into TalkSport and he doesn't make a noise until it's 6:05. So that's his first noise. But honestly, it was like absolutely, it was funny because obviously it's the Champions League final, but we're on free-to-air TV as well as, you know, Stan, and everyone's like, oh, I've got to take this seriously. And the commentator can't talk. I was in fits.
Well, he's done a Harry Kane on it, hasn't he? He's clearly declared himself fit for the big game and then let the side down because he obviously wasn't.
So credit to Don Goodman. We actually then took the BT commentary team. So like, I didn't hear Don Goodman doing the trophy lift on his own. Poor Don in a booth somewhere trying to do this. But I did switch to BT, which meant, as we were talking about before the pod, I got the injury time plug for Solihull Moors versus Chesterfield, which I thought the timing was absolutely hilarious. Like, of course, look, we'll get on to Wrexham Grimsby, but I thought that timing was beautiful, John.
Midday today, as advertised at the 93rd minute by Fletch. Lovely. I'm fired up for that game. It's the game of the weekend for me. Come on, Solihull Moors. Yeah, brilliant. Actually, talking to people called in to do a job they're not used to, let's credit Jonathan Wilson here for his reporting on what went on before and after the game with fans. Very good, Jonathan. Let's credit him with that.
I was very much out of my comfort zone.
Yeah. Well, we'll get onto that in 1 second. Just a couple of. I thought I liked. You know, obviously you've had all this delay, you've had all this panic, and then they have this opening ceremony where you're like, nobody, literally not a person wants this. As Richard Osman tweeted, this is about as welcome as a game of five-a-side would be before a Camila Cabello gig. He's absolutely right. I thought she performed admirably and very well. Just don't need it.
Yeah, the thing is, they wouldn't normally show that, would they? Normally they'd keep to, you know, Michael Owen and Steven Gerrard talking, but they talk so much in that delay that... And Michael Owen talking about how no one could know what had caused this, and just again and repeating and repeating, and just the relief on Jake Humphrey's face. A friend of mine noticed that at one point Jake Humphrey took his earpiece out. He was so exasperated with what was going on. It was. I mean, all credit, they got the show on the road.
Well, he's been on quite a journey. Yeah, yeah. So you know.
And to be fair, he did go to the correct stadium in the end.
anyway, look, that'll do for part one. It's interesting you say that, because there was so much to look ahead to this game. We were actually quite pleased to have an extra 45 minutes to say, look, we could start breaking down things tactically and look at, you know, all those things that you sort of are really pushed for time when you've only got like a half hour lead in. Anyway, that'll do for part one. Part two, we will talk about what Jonathan Wilson was reporting on what happened outside the stadium. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Jamie says, is mentioning the live show as a guaranteed way of getting on the podcast, as you use them as a transition to plug the events? It absolutely is, Jamie. And we have a live tour. Go to myticket.co.uk. Leeds on the 13th of June with this exact panel of people. Birmingham, me, Barry, John Bruin, joined by Jordan, Jarrett, Brian, Lars Sivertsen and Philippe Auclair in Manchester, Lars and Mark Langdon in Dublin on two nights, Troy Townsend, Jonathan Wilson, Nicky Bandini in Hackney on the 8th of July, Ellis James, Barney, Ronnie Sidlow on the 9th, Philippe Auclair and Jonathan Wilson in Glasgow on the 13th, myticket.co.uk. I've scheduled a lot of tweets, so I hope they don't come out at sort of inopportune moments. Let's talk about what happened off the pitch then, with the Liverpool fans trying to get in, and what happened to Liverpool fans as they left the stadium as well. Rob Harris joins us, global sports correspondent from AP. Hey, Rob.
Hey there.
I'm just going to read this email from Dan, who said, long-time listener, first-time emailing. I'm currently travelling back from Paris. I felt I had to share my experiences gaining entry to the ground last night. I arrived at the stadium at 7 p.m. I didn't get through gate Y until 8:15. It was an absolute mess. Those with genuine tickets being told by stewards their tickets are fakes when they wouldn't scan for entry. Fans without tickets jumping the fence, or just desperate attempts by ticketed fans to get in for the biggest game of our season. There were definitely fans and locals trying to blag their way in or rush and push their way in. I thought you weren't able to get close to the turnstiles without a ticket, but mine was never checked before the turnstiles. The turnstiles were blocked by big metal gates at gate Y. These were open and closed constantly to control the flow of people through and prevent the turnstiles becoming overrun. But this was never communicated. Every time they shut, you didn't know if they'd open again. Every time they shut those big metal gates, they'd push, shove and crush people back against the barriers. At one point, a fan inside told us there were five down injured the other side of the gate, getting medical assistance. Eventually, there was some communication from the stewards telling us how long to expect to wait before they let us in. 90% of those in the queues at that time behaved impeccably and remained calm. Once they opened the gates again, one steward came out looking for a fight and had to be calmed by other stewards. Tensions were so high. Kids were terrified. I'm 33. I found it terrifying. Over the hour in which I got closer to those entrance gates, watching the madness in front of me, all I could think was, how is it the only way I'm getting to see Liverpool play the Champions League final is by risking my health to get through all of that? This is what I saw and experienced. Some blame lies on both sides, but the organisation, communication and treatment was so bad. I was lucky to get in. Most of the seats around me remained empty throughout the game. This was my first European Cup final. I don't think I want to go to another one. Look, thanks for getting in touch, Darren. Look, we're glad you're okay. Rob, you were going in and out of the ground. I saw you sort of posting videos as well. What was your experience of last night?
I mean, it did seem a logistical chaos. It's organisationally, there are flaws. And I experienced them even arriving at the stadium around 3 hours or so before kickoff. So we had the fan experience. We were tackling the issues in terms of the train line being down, one of them because of the strike, went on another one, got into the stadium area and started to encounter a lack of information, few people to actually guide fans initially, large queues as well, just to get in, bottlenecks starting to form. And myself and a fellow journalist being given wrong information in terms of just where we were even going to. So that was just a sort of snapshot. And it took us about an hour to get into the right place as well, which sort of showed the issues around 3 hours before the game. Particularly that significant when, of course, that UEFA statement was made in the stadium announcing that delay was due to fans turning up late. Well, there were a lot of fans there early, and the challenges were actually them getting in. And that was certainly what was witnessed outside immediately the inner security perimeter where they were showing their tickets, having to get them scanned. There were just hundreds of Liverpool fans, so many of them, who were waiting patiently, if not very frustrated about the... you know, the struggles to get in and the infrastructure's inability to cope with filtering them into the stadium.
UEFA made a statement. In the lead up to the game, the turnstiles at the Liverpool end became blocked by thousands of fans who purchased fake tickets, which did not work in the turnstiles. This created a build-up of fans trying to get in. As a result, the kickoff was delayed by 35 minutes to allow as many fans as possible with genuine tickets to gain access. As numbers outside the stadium continued to build up after kickoff, the police dispersed them with tear gas and forced them away from the stadium. UEFA is sympathetic to those affected by these events and will further review these matters urgently together with the French police and authorities and with the French Football Federation. Look, you were there as well, Wilson. What surprised me was how UEFA made such a categoric statement about what happened while it was still happening.
Well, and changed it as well. So it started off saying, it, you know, fans were having late. But I mean, I got there a couple of hours before Rob. I was there, you know, as John knows, I like to get to a stadium early. So they opened the gates to the media at 4 in theory, though in practice it didn't actually open until near 4:30. The scanners for hour passes weren't working perfectly, so I had a bit of a problem getting in. So you know, that idea that just because they couldn't scan your ticket means your ticket was counterfeit, I'd be very skeptical of that. So yeah, they said it was down to fans arriving late. By the end of the game, that had changed to this counterfeit ticket thing, which again, I just don't know how you would know that at that stage without a proper investigation. To get to the corner of the ground where the problem seemed to be, which happened to be where the media entrance was, to sort of gate U, the southwest corner of the ground, you would naturally go to the RER station D, and then you go along the sort of a 3 carriageway road, and there's a pavement sort of built up on the stadium side of that. So it's quite a narrow area anyway, and police had sort of blocked the access road to that, which made sense, blocked it to cars, but then nobody was allowed to walk on that. You had to walk on the pavement, which they then semi-blocked with 2 police vans parked over the pavement. Now, I assumed at 4 p.m. French time that they were just there because they were unloading and they'd move, but those vans were still there at kickoff. And so that led to a crush, and presumably that was a deliberate effort to try and slow the flow of people to the ground. But what I don't understand is why tickets weren't being checked as you came out of the RER station. That's a big, big road that was closed. You could have put up checks there quite easily, and that would have been a way to filter away fans without tickets or to sort out any problems with tickets that weren't scanning or fake tickets way before you got anywhere near the stadium. So why, I just don't understand, but it seems to me really, really obvious. I don't understand why that wasn't done. And then clearly there was horrendous overreaction from French police, which has been a feature of football in France. I mean, I remember back in 2007 doing it was Lille v Manchester United, but the game was played in Lens because the Lille stadium was being renovated. And United fans were not behaving particularly well, it should be said, but there was behind the goal, there was a fence, and United fans in an enclosure there, which was very clearly overcrowded, and there was a bit of panic. And French police just fired tear gas in. And that seems to be their first reaction to any buildup of people, is fire tear gas. But obviously, that then affects people who just can't get out of there, and it creates panic. So that appeared to be what happened last night as well. And I know that, I don't know if Rob got caught up in this, but his colleague Steve Douglas was bundled into a room by French police and made to delete footage of what he'd filmed.
Yeah, that was something that did happen, and I experienced it myself as well when I was actually by one of the gates trying to show what was happening, filming on my phone. There was an intervention by stewards trying to stop me filming the police, and actually, it did get quite forceful with them. And having seen already and heard of that experience just a few minutes earlier, I actually sprinted across to UEFA officials back closer towards the stadium straight away, knowing actually it was better to be with them. And they actually then intervened to try to get the stewards to, and the, you know, the security officials, as it were, and the police to ensure that our media rights were being protected, because our conversations with those fans that did become ones through the fence were helping to inform actually what was going on, to actually show what was going on, and also in cases to show clearly, for instance, the fact as people were trying to climb over the fences, people without any identifiable club colours, there were Liverpool fans chanting that for them to get down, to deter them from doing so. And, you know, this was something that was unfolding even as the game was underway. And talking about that sort of tear gas first strategy, the game, what was, I think it might have been about 20 minutes old at that point, perhaps, and the riot police were firing tear gas from the inner security area right by the press entrance. You'd already gone through the ticket scanning turnstiles. They were firing it outside beyond the fences when there can't be that many people I could see beyond there, but it was seen as a sort of just first resort means of trying to disperse the people who, again, didn't look like from afar that they were any identifiable fans of the team, but perhaps were those people trying to get in.
We had so many messages from Liverpool fans who had a terrible experience. We also got this question from Luke saying, will Football Weekly be ignoring the videos of Liverpool fans climbing over the barriers to illegally enter the stadium like the rest of the British media, or discuss it? Like the Euros final, it's an alarming trend where British fans think the rules don't apply to them. Most questions have not been asked. You know, that was, if I'm trying to be fair on all the correspondence we had, most we've had a terrible experience. Clearly, Rob, the issue is if the authorities can find one or two people doing this, then they can use that as their excuse for all their actions.
And that's what we saw from the Interior Minister last night, from the Sports Minister. They were very quick to go on Twitter to post about there being thousands of English fans being to blame for this. And yes, undoubtedly, there are some videos showing some pockets of Liverpool fans perhaps trying to get in. But the majority, the vast majority that we were watching, particularly in the key time approaching kickoff, the sort of half an hour or so before kickoff, there were just thousands of Liverpool fans waiting in line, speaking to us of their frustration, but just waiting and waiting to be filtered and sort of exasperated by the authorities and their inability to be able to sort of filter them into the stadium. So, you know, that was largely the experience of just watching how they were, you know, their systems were just struggling to cope. And maybe it does come down to things like the barcode ticket system, the fact you have to get your phone out, find where the app is and go through to find the code. Then it has to be scanned by the steward on the gate. So that does create extra delays potentially within that process. But the question is why those checks again were only taking place so close to the stadium. And there did seem to be a sort of general lack of staff. You didn't get the people on megaphone shouting out announcements, reassuring messages, which we can often get around sort of English sports venues, whether it's, you know, horse racing as well as football, you know, lots of people, at least just to calm things down if there is a bit of frustration as well, just to inform what's going on.
Can I ask, lads, Jonathan and Rob, and this is going to sound like an insinuation, but it isn't. It is genuine curiosity. Why did Real Madrid's fans not have similar problems?
It's a different side of the ground. So you wouldn't be approaching it from that same access route to the southwest. So I think that's the basic reason that that their access routes weren't as narrow. It may be there were fewer fans there who had, you know, counterfeit tickets were an issue. I don't know, but I think fundamentally it's just the way the ground is laid out. And I also think, you know, this excuse from the authorities about, well, some fans try to push their way in or jump fences, that can't be a surprise to them. Like, if you're going to put on a game, you have to take that into account, and that's why you have to filter this much earlier. And I think it's hugely worrying that the final of Euros, this, and to be honest, in Seville last week, week before last now, isn't it? For the Rangers Eintracht Frankfurt game, that was Rangers fans there behaved astonishingly well, given how many of them there were. And that could easily have gone off. Yeah, there was a terrible lack of organisation and signage at the stadium. I mean, the number of Rangers fans I saw there, and it's only Rangers fans because where the press box was happened to be more Rangers fans there, wandering about going, where's my seat? I don't know where my seat is. And, you know, they'd see us wearing a lanyard and assume we knew something, which obviously we didn't. But I, the way that these big fines being put on post-COVID have all been shambolic.
Liverpool released a statement saying we're hugely disappointed at the stadium entry issues and breakdown of security perimeter that Liverpool fans faced this evening at the Stade de France. This is the greatest match in European football. Supporters should not have to experience the scenes we've witnessed tonight. We have officially requested a formal investigation into the causes of these unacceptable issues. Joey says, are you looking forward to UEFA launching their own full-scale investigation and then finding absolutely no wrongdoing? What happens now, Rob?
Well, there's never actually been a public UEFA investigation into the Wembley disorder as well. You think it might have been useful for them to look from their own organisational sense of how the preparation went. We had a thorough report, obviously, from the FA, which casts a lot of blame on England fans. And, you know, that was obviously quite difficult for them to have to talk through. But yeah, nothing from the FA, UEFA on that. And I think it comes down to how they're dealing with the local authorities and actually future events in France and to pick up these learnings, if there are any. There just weren't many UEFA staff around. It was all local police and stewards. Perhaps there should have been more police from England, potentially, staff from Liverpool, which could have actually helped to act as a sort of intermediary in terms of communication. Not that the liability is on them to do so. You would hope the police could be able to secure the area and the stadium organisers could be able to sort of get a system in place that would allow them to be able to get in okay. And I think obviously a lack of communication was just quite a theme of what was going on. And also just the fact that there was disregard for the fans who were absolutely completely blameless, those just waiting, like the asthmatic Liverpool fan who talked of her experience to me about being tear gassed, being caught up in this when all she was doing was waiting to get into the stadium, and she was waving a ticket at me, showing that, look, we're just here, we've been here for hours trying to get in. So, you know, there are clearly some struggles, and this is also a stadium that always has a lot of space around it. It's not like Wembley, where one of the issues around the Euros final was how hemmed in the stadium is with the shopping centre, all the apartment blocks and everything right nearby. Stade de France does have those sort of big open spaces. There were roads blocked off. There were the shops that were closed that would normally be open, like a fitness centre right near the entrances for the Liverpool fans. So that space perhaps wasn't maximised for use to ensure a better system.
I mean, the one thing I'd say about that, Rob, is though there is that really busy road, the Avenue de N, I think, the six-lane road. And that does create a problem that you have to go through an underpass to get there. But that I think is why it was the issues were with Liverpool fans, because that was the side they were approaching from. The other side is much more open. But as I say, I think they could have done checks much nearer the RER station, which would have filtered out a lot of issues if the issue was people turning up without valid tickets.
Look, some messages, you know, tweets from people we know and trust and like, you know, Kelly Kate saying, oh, it's fans with fake tickets now, is it UEFA? Who's responsible for ticketing? Who's responsible for making sure the tickets are checked before they even get near a turnstile at a major event? Complete abdication of responsibility. We've been here before. Carl Clements, the Liverpool historian, said, that's it for me. Game over. Not asked about me. But my 9-year-old suffered the effects of tear gas after the match, a football match. The police were throwing them for fun. I got hit directly. So toxic. Definitely not a place for kids. Football is finished.
It's worth bearing in mind that most of these Liverpool fans paid money to go to this game, a lot of money. Those tickets aren't cheap. And I've seen said they were treated like animals. Animals don't get tear gas fired at them. They get herded. Yeah, cattle, you know, get herded into pens and whatnot. They don't get tear gas. And if you tear gassed animals, you would be subjected to the full force of the law for being cruel. What should have been the experience of a lifetime for many of those people, win, lose or draw, well, they weren't going to draw, win or lose, has been, you know, so many of them seem to have had an absolutely horrible time, and that's just, it's just not right.
It's not right, it's not acceptable. And I suppose, Rob, nobody got seriously injured as far as we know, which when you start hearing about crushes and bottlenecks before the game, you know, I was on air, now you're obviously working, you start to get really fearful. And so, although it's not a positive, because this is a pretty desperate situation, that is just one thing to cling to, I guess.
Yeah, the fact that some fans I was speaking to were finding it quite traumatic experiencing it, given their past experiences going to Liverpool games many years ago as well. They were reflecting on that as the situation was unfolding to me as well. And we are, as it seems now, thankful that there was nothing serious that seems to be in terms of injuries last night. But, you know, there hugely was the potential for this to be, particularly the way the situation also was being inflamed by that tear gas pepper spray that was being deployed. And, you know, you can see the way it was in areas where perhaps there were other ways of policing it, to disperse the crowds if they wanted to warn off perhaps if there were, you know, greater numbers. You know, there were fans, not fans, I would say, there were people, local people, perhaps I could see the ones trying to climb over the fence, where, you know, perhaps there weren't enough numbers just to go in and use that form of policing rather than just firing off tear gas.
Rob, thanks so much, mate. Appreciate your time.
Good to speak, guys.
Rob Harris there from AP. And that'll do for part two. Part three will round up any other business. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Let's talk about the National League semi-final. Wrexham 4, Grimsby 5. One all at half-time, and then the game got ridiculous. 1-2, 2-2, 3-2, 3-3, 3-4, 4-4, 4-5. Last minute of extra time. Barry, as you said, the most entertaining game you saw yesterday.
It's one of the most entertaining games I've ever seen. It reminded me of the Charlton-Sunderland game in 97, was it? Or 98, the playoff final. It was just incredible. It had everything. Goals, penalties, a hand of God goal that shouldn't have been given, controversial decisions, something astonishing, a couple of astonishing goals, and some extremely questionable refereeing. Wrexham, obviously owned by Ryan Reynolds and Rob McElhenney, they didn't get the Hollywood ending they were hoping for, so they lost the FA Trophy last weekend, got knocked out of the National League playoffs yesterday. But
so they basically just nicked the plot of one of those Sunderland documentaries.
But it was a truly outstanding game of football. I just loved every minute of it. And Phil Parkinson, the Wrexham manager afterwards, was absolutely furious with the referee. He really didn't hold back. But the fact of the matter is, Wrexham got a penalty they shouldn't have got. And they also were given a goal that was a blatant handball by your old friend Paul Mullen, Max. I don't know, did you have a little chuckle at Wrexham's expense because they nicked your star striker?
What? No. I mean, that's the interesting thing, John, isn't it? That when Ryan Reynolds and Rob McElhenney came into Wrexham, I think there was this genuine positivity about, look, here are some people who seem nice, who are doing the right thing, you know, who aren't a petro state, you know. Ryan Reynolds' human rights record, as far as I know, is pretty good. And so there was like sort of positivity about it. But the way football fandom works is, it doesn't take long for people to sort of point and laugh and go, not as easy as you thought it would be, mate.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I allowed myself a laugh. But last week, yeah, the FA Trophy, there was, I think they scored an offside goal. And there was footage of the Hollywood contingent, including, I believe, Sir David of Beckham, all celebrating a goal that was clearly offside. Everyone else in the stadium had noticed was offside. But there was this sort of point, like, do these guys even know that what offside is? Yeah, and I suppose the inverse snobbery that in football means that that idea of there not being a Hollywood ending is exactly the ending that everyone else wants. For yeah, a club like that, and I'm sure that the documentary series is going to be really very interesting. But I'm told actually that one of the reasons that they decided to go on this journey is watching the Sunderland documentary. So there you go.
Is that right?
Yes.
And I mean, look, the interesting thing as well is, it doesn't matter what level of football you're at. Like, you know, when you're sort of look at it, you know, in sort of the macro terms, you know, Wrexham are a small club. Isn't it great they've got this money? But suddenly, if you're, you know, like Charlie Baker, who I work with on TalkSport, you know, he's a Torquay fan. He's like, I don't want another club with money in the National League. I don't need these money bags bastards buying, you know. Paul Mullen came from, what, we went out to League One. They got Ben Tozer from, who was Ben Tozer playing for? Cheltenham, wasn't it? I think, with the long throw. That is like, that's like sort of Newcastle buying Kieran Trippier, you know, a La Liga winner at right back. You know, they're going, this isn't fair. This is, you know, this isn't how it should be.
Yeah, it's like Salford City, you know, the Nevilles, the class of 92. You speak to fans of teams in that division. The team they all really like to beat is Gary Neville's Salford City. And for that same reason, that celeb factor.
Grimsby will now face Solihull Moors or Chesterfield, as you know.
Well, yeah.
it's been plugged during the 92nd minute of the Champions League final.
Where can I watch that, Max?
You can watch it on BT Sport at midday. I mean, that was the thing. We had the BT commentary. Our poor Australian viewers, they won't be getting that at midday, will they? The final is on the 5th of June at the London Stadium. Also, well done to Port Vale. Port Vale fans, I presume we don't talk about you a lot on this podcast. Congratulations to Robbie Williams and the rest of you.
Phil Taylor.
It's a big moment. Yeah. Phil Taylor as well, of course.
Yeah.
Is he Vale? I always thought he was Stoke.
Definitely,
is terrible,
he's definitely Vale.
I watched that game as well. It was the least entertaining of the three games I saw yesterday, but it's hard for the cockles of your heart not to be warm by that Port Vale win, with all due respect to Nigel Clough and Mansfield, because the Port Vale manager, Darrell Clark, lost his daughter in February. He was on an extended compassionate leave and came back recently, and he was incredibly emotional after the game and dedicated the win to his daughter Ellie. So you know, all the best to him and everyone else at Port Vale.
Yeah, absolutely. The Championship playoff final is today. We're recording on the Sunday, so there's no pod on the Monday. We will look back at this on the next pod, which I think is a mailbag on Wednesday. Daniel says, thoughts on the A-League Grand Final? Yeah, well done to Western United, who beat Melbourne City. They were the two teams who were in the Grand Final, so my reporting of this tournament is getting more impressive by the podcast. Yeah, they went 1-0 up very early. And then got a second, and I went to bed at half time. So I think it finished 2-0. I definitely know that Western United won the game. As I said before, it's a long way away, Australia. How are we meant to keep up with all this football? But well done to Western United. They're a pretty new team in the A-League. The one thing that I did spot, or that has happened, it's been quite controversial over here, is they have advert breaks when goals are scored. So that was a big kind of, yeah, I know. And this has been happening all season. I tweeted about it yesterday and everyone in the office was like, this has been happening all season. Why are you talking about it now? We all know. Yeah, so there's sort of barely a replay and then they just have an advert, which, you know, could be a portent of what might happen elsewhere around the world, but hopefully not. But look, that was a good win for them. And this is from Will, who says, can John... Well, first he mentioned Jonathan Wilson's incredibly Macam voice note after Sunderland's playoff victory, where he was absolutely, he'd spent 10 hours in the company of Macams. And it was, honestly, Wilson, it was an absolute joy to hear you talk like that.
I mean, yeah, if you put me with Macams again, it will happen again. Yeah,
it was like Dermot Gallagher. It was like, it's just a sudden change. Anyway, Will says, can John defend Neil Young from Barry's outrageous, quote, busker who got lucky jibe a few pods back? Would some busker be able to play Cortez the Killer or Cowgirl in the Sand?
Did Barry really say that? Yeah? Wow. Okay. Yep.
I'm going to be honest there. I made a mistake. Busker who got lucky is more Bob Dylan.
Yeah. Well, no, I mean, Neil Young has done the old, you know, one-man band type of thing. But no, Neil Young is a brilliant, brilliant guitarist. His singing might not be to everyone's taste, but as I look at my vinyl collection, I've got a lot of Neil Young records. Cortez the Killer is a prime cut. And when he plays, and the thing is with Neil Young, he has this thing where he sounds like he shouldn't be very good at the guitar because it's all very chaotic, but he makes it sound absolutely brilliant. Like it's almost like self-taught. You can tell it's Neil Young playing a guitar as soon as you hear it. Yeah, the guy's a genius. He's made some very bad records too, but that's because he's made records for 50 years. But yeah, I love Neil Young, yeah.
Thank you, John. We've set the record straight because, unbelievably, that upset more people than most of the things we say about football on this podcast. On Wednesday, we're recording a mailbag episode answering all your questions. So send them in, please. Anything you like, serious, silly, as creative as you want to be. footballweekly@theguardian.com. But that'll do for today. Thank you, Jonathan Wilson.
Cheers, thank you.
Thank you, John Bruin.
Thanks, Max Rushton.
Thanks, Barry Glendenning.
Thank you.
I'll see you on the radio in about an hour, Barry.
Yeah, where we'll do the whole thing all over again.
Well, we'll repeat what John Bruin and Jonathan Wilson say, but say it before this pod is published, so we appear like we know what we're talking about. Football Weekly was produced by Joel Grove. Our executive producer is Danielle Stevens.
This is The Guardian.